We have seven bills on the agenda. We do have a room reserved for tonight if we don't get our work done, so I would hope that we can move along. Senator, first bill we'll talk about this afternoon is Senate Bill 2911, Senator Berglund, window fall prevention devices, requirements, modifications. I know we had a window bill, what, it was last year or the year before, but we're modifying, obviously, this that legislation. So welcome, Senator Berglund, to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment with an oral change to it.
Okay, state your oral.
Would be to change the number 48 to 42.
Okay, I think we can take that to get the bill in the order that Senator Scheid moves it.
I do.
A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Berglund, on the bill.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee who were here last year, you remember that we had a window screen bill to help prevent falls from new constructed multiple unit buildings. And basically, the bill went to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to incorporate into the building code after consultation with a committee that had a lot of window manufacturing representatives on the committee. And the committee recommended that the height of the windows that would have to have the special protection on them would be windows that are less than 42 inches off of the floor. The Commissioner of Labor and Industry crossed out their recommendation and put 22 inches in the
rulemaking, or where'd they do that?
Building code rule. In the building code rule that was adopted. So, in other words, the
24 inches,
excuse me. Crossed out the 42 and put in 24. So basically ignored the recommendation of the committee. I believe that windows that are 24 inches above the floor need more protection. I believe that small children can climb over to a window that would be that low to the floor and still fall out of them pretty easily.
And of Senator Berglund, can I ask you a question? Maybe I think you said that we passed legislation at a certain inch requirement, and the building codes through regulation superseded what the law said? Or am I?
We didn't actually specify a
number
of inches. I wanted you to, but you wanted it to go to a committee to recommend to the department for it to be included in the building code. So that's what we did. And now I'm back here because the commissioner ignored the recommendation of the committee, and I believe the height of the window off of the floor that has been placed in the window in the building code by the commissioner is not adequate enough. Many small toddler children will be falling out of these windows, and the whole purpose was to give more protection to children because we have dozens, if not hundreds, of children falling out of windows every year and being, you know, very badly injured or if not killed. And of course, this whole issue came to me because I had a couple of children fall out of windows in my district, and one child was injured and one child died. And So all I'm asking with this bill is that we direct the commissioner to accept the recommendation of the committee, and that windows that are less than 42 inches off the ground would have the safety screens or devices.
Well, so I see we never did in law or in the bill put.
Right, I did. We left I did have a handout for you about the original law, and of course I have just one of many articles about children continuing to fall from windows. And I have a witness if you want to take him now, Mr. Chairman.
See, in the original, there was a final report shall include a summary of safety. Has that report been?
I haven't seen the report.
Looks like we kind of we mandated a report to come back with certain.
Right. I don't have the report. I do have.
They did not do that in time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm informed they did not do that in time. I don't know if they're still working on it or not.
Huh? Who was supposed to do that? Was it the Commissioner of Health? Or what?
Yes.
What?
Maybe.
What am I missing around here? I mean, we're the legislative branch, and we make some requirements of agencies. And I mean, whether you like the results or you don't, I mean, if we ask somebody to do something, they should get taken care of. But
well, I mean, this is happening a lot because, you know, the departments were unallotted by the governor after the legislature went home, and maybe at the time they thought they could do this with resources they had, and maybe then they found out later they weren't going to have all the resources they thought they had. I don't know. I just do know one thing. The 24 inches off the floor is too low. Little tiny toddlers and even kids that can crawl are going to get over to one of those windows and fall out. And the purpose was to create safer windows for young children. And I believe the committee's number of 42 inches is a better number, and I'd like us to adopt that and tell the commissioner to put the 42 back in.
Okay. Did you wish to have a witness speak?
Yeah, I did have somebody come, so.
Welcome to the Minnesota Senate, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jim Graham from Minneapolis, from the 61st Senate District. I sat on that committee that made that rule. In fact, I was the only non-paid member that sat on that committee. Pretty much everybody else was either a paid official or a representative of the window industry. It was absolutely stacked with the lobbyists of the window industry. And yet that committee came up with the 42 inches. I think the issue today, sir, is that, and committee members, is that the Senate of elected officials, elected senators, passed a law with a certain intent. And an appointed official took it upon themselves to arrogantly ignore that intent and to change what came out of the committee. I think that the 24 inches, even in that committee, was discussed that it would probably cause more deaths and more accidents than if it were not even changed. And as I say, that committee was made up of a body of people whose intent from the very beginning was to either ignore this or try to mitigate it as much as possible, and yet they still came up with 42 inches. And I think that I think this is a misapplication of law, and I think that that commissioner should be censured for that. After that law went into effect, by the way, we still had people, reporters, calling me to do interviews about children that had gone out of windows, and they had thought that that law had been changed. After that law was passed, other states, including Iowa, Oregon, the city of London sent people to look at the law that Minnesota had before they knew it was going to be 24 inches, to look at changing their own laws to adopt what Minnesota had, they thought, done. Then subsequently they called me and said, what happened? What happened to this law? And what happened was that one person decided the intent of the House of Representatives and the intent of the Senate didn't matter. and that he could take it upon himself to subvert the intent of the elected officials. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to express my, I'm going to say it for the second time. I don't, if you're for or against the bill, it doesn't matter that, well, it does matter a lot, but that's not the issue with this guy. I mean, you tell the department to do something in law. Don't tell me they're too busy. I mean, you get people that could do it, but that does trouble me. Okay, I believe we have some people on the other side.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. I just wanted to have a little better understanding of what exactly is going on. I'm reading this handout from the Department of Labor and Industry, I guess, proposed rules. Does this only apply to apartments, houses, condominiums, hotels, and motels?
That's true, sir. That was the opinion of the committee.
And that's what the proposal is only applying to?
Yes, sir. I guess only in new construction, sir.
And only in new construction.
And only in new construction. And by the way, one of the complaints is that this may cost more. I know for a fact buildings that have installed the window screens, and in fact have saved a tremendous amount of money because they don't have to replace those shoddy screens that are required by law to be on their buildings. The building where those the two buildings where those two children fell out that precipitated this, in fact, has saved about $300 to $500 a week during the summer months because of that savings. It saves money for those operators, and it costs no more when they're installing the windows, sir.
Thank you. I just was uncertain.
Sure. That's okay. Do we have the department? Did you wish to, Mr. Joachim?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. I believe there's some misinformation that. To try and clarify here a little bit, we did establish an advisory committee to review these this information. We looked at the national model standards that are in the national model codes. The committee had a number of ideas. One was the 42-inch. The others were to address the national model standards. The national model standard is 24 inches, so that's what we put in the rule to follow the national model standards. And that's what we currently have in rule, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Who appointed this? What this commission was made up of? Who?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would assume it was an advisory committee established by the commissioner. I'm not sure how it reads in the law.
Mm. Okay. Okay, I think we've heard from some industry people too. Anybody wish to come forward and good afternoon and welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Karen Lanier, L-I-N-N-E-R. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota and I'm the Director of Codes and Research there. And I also served on the advisory committee. I don't have a list of advisory committee members, but I know there was someone from the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Safety Council. We also had, I don't think they were an official member, but someone from Public Health came and talked to us about the data for falls from windows as well. And we can certainly get you that list. But the reason I would like to speak to you today is I've been involved on lots of code advisory committees. And I'm always amazed at how many things I learn every time I'm around the table with people that are on those committees because they bring lots of different perspectives. And if this were only about window fall protection for kids, we probably wouldn't be having this hearing. But there's two competing public policy requirements when you talk about windows in the occupancies we're talking about. So I just want to walk you through a quick example. And what I'd like to talk to you about is the ability to keep kids in windows and the ability to have people get out in case of fires. So think about the last time you're on an airplane when the flight attendant says, please look for your exit and consider that your exit may be, the closest exit may be behind you. They do that because they want you to get off that plane as fast as possible and you're not familiar with planes, right? They're different configurations. You go to a hotel, when you close the hotel room door, there's a map there. It tells you where your room is, it tells you where the stairway is. And because I'm the daughter of a retired firefighter, That's what my dad taught me to look for when you first go into a hotel room is, how are you going to get out? So let's move to an apartment building. There's a fire. What we've all been taught to do, if there's smoke, you get down. You crawl to the door, right? The first exit. You feel if it's hot. If it's hot, you're not supposed to go out the door. So what do? You look for another exit. That's going to be a window. And what's going to happen when you get to that window, if there is smoke in the room, people die in fires from smoke inhalation. So you want to keep low. That's where the oxygen is. When you open that window, you get oxygen, and you also have a better chance of getting out because the firefighters can see you and know where you are. What happens with a window fall protection device, and I want to clarify something, the screens that were mentioned before, my sources from the Window and Door Manufacturers Association say there are no screens that comply with national standards because they've been tested and they don't apply to the ASTM standard. And I'm totally open to more data on that because that's what I've been told. But that ASTM standard does two things that are really important. You can either use a window guard, you can use a device, or you can use a screen if it complies with the standard. And the reason it's so technical and written is because you want to be able to get out in case of a fire, and you want that thing to reset every time. So if you do an override to raise it more than 4 inches to protect window falls for kids, it resets every time you bring it down. Okay? So let's say you're in a fire. You go to a window. It has a window guard on it for fall protection. That window's going to open 4 inches. And then you're going to have to unlock the next thing to open the window all the way. If that window height gets higher where these are required, you're changing the reach height on what you have to do to open that window. So if you think about a sill being 24 inches, I'm just going to stand up to show you. Where are you unlatching? And then where are you doing the window, that window fall protection device in a fire? As those goes higher, it's putting one more barrier up for folks. Now, before it was mentioned that this is only for new construction, that's not true. If an apartment building manager replaces the windows, as it states in the Minnesota State Building Code, they're required to follow this law. In an existing building, let's say they put energy-efficient windows in, which is a laudable goal. So there are competing interests in this public policy, and that's why I'd rather see it occur in a code advisory committee meeting, because fire deaths far exceed child falls. Both are incredibly tragic and something we'd want to avoid if we could prevent every single one. So it's a competing public policy interest, and you need to have all the facts before deciding on that, and that's why the window was set. The sill height was set at 24 inches. It's most likely to prevent a fall. It's most likely not to affect a reach range on those types of windows. Thank you for your time.
Okay, anybody else? Senator Berglund?
I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the testimony. The screens do exist. They're used on all public housing in the state of Minnesota. And the reason public housing went to using these kind of screens is because of the vandalism that they were experiencing nationwide and the cost they had in dealing with the vandalism. So they adopted the screens for maintenance purposes, not for safety purposes, but that's what they use on all the public housing, and so the screens do exist. Secondly, in regard to the issue of fire, we met with the fire officials when we originally proposed this bill a year ago, and they told us they don't have any trouble getting through anything. They take their hatchet and they just go right through anything to get into the building if they need to enter a building through a window. So they didn't have any problem with the screen bill a year ago when we had it up. Secondly, these buildings are sprinkled. They have to be sprinkled by code. And the reason that was adopted is because the fire departments don't want people jumping out of windows that are, you know, 4, 5, 6 feet off the stories off the ground, because it's dangerous for them that they might kill themselves in the fall. So these buildings are sprinkled so that if there is a fire, they're far safer than buildings that don't have sprinkler systems in them.
Okay, ma'am, you want to respond? Then we've got a couple, I think, Jack Horner's there and a couple other people maybe.
If I could just respond to that, Mr. Chair and committee members and Senator Berglund. That's not completely true. If the windows are replaced in an existing building that's unsprinklered, they require the window fall protection, and the building would not be sprinklered, according to the state building code.
Okay, Mr. Horner, did you wish to? That's not your 30-page remarks, is it, there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I'm starting on page 79, if that's okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members. Jack Horner, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Actually, Karen Lanier gave the flavor of what I wanted to say. I'm going to add just a couple of things. The advisory committee did indeed consider a number of different heights of windows for the exemption. We had expert testimony, John Rossler of Minnesota Department of Health and fire officials, and we looked at the national standards. It really is a balancing between window fall safety, of course, everyone wants that, and fire safety, fire prevention safety. Also, and Karen talked about that, and I won't belabor it. Even though fire safety device, window fall devices, either the window lock type devices or the guards, can come in easily unlatched or easily removable models in order to comply with fire codes, they are nevertheless, they slow down egress at least to some extent, and sometimes for little kids. For example, it's assumed that apartment owners, condominium builders will probably go for the window control devices. These are basically devices that are located in a double hung window, maybe 4 inches above the top of the lower sash, and they are spring loaded so that when you release them, you can open the window all the way, but then when you close the window, they snap into place again, preventing you from opening the window all the way. They're not like the old vent flow prohibitor or point a lock point that you set one way or the other and just leave it there. These, you can open the window, and then they click back into position. So what that means is you are balancing, for example, a little kid who's caught in a fire would have to be able to span the window, I mean, if an adult wasn't there, or even an adult who's got mobility impaired or in a wheelchair or frozen shoulders like an old friend of mine who reached the point where she couldn't lift her arms above her shoulders. You have to be able to reach up and do both latches in order to get the window open enough. The building code requires 5.7 square feet of clear opening in new construction. That's fairly large. It requires a double hung window of maybe 3 by 5 feet. And so the higher you go, the more difficult it is. And it's assumed that most builders will probably use that. So it's balancing not only fire, but the ability to open the window. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the statute directing this work directed the building code division to base it on national standards. The National International Building Code Standard, which adopted here in Minnesota for window fall prevention, is indeed a 24-inch exemption. That is to say, windows whose sill is below 24 inches don't have to have the or do have to have the protection above that. You don't have to have that. That is the national standard, and nobody could figure out why it should be different than that, and so that's why that was adopted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Saltzman.
You know, I'm not familiar with exactly how this is going to work with the rules. Could you clarify, Mr. Horner, or if someone could clarify for me, if these devices require one or the other or all. So, for example, you've just described, we've been talking about these window locks where you can open a window 4 inches or then open it additional, correct? And then once you open it, does it also have to have a screen on it? Or does it, because it appears here that it's or in these proposed rules. So do you have to have all of them so that there's, first of all, a barrier to someone opening the window, and then a screen in addition to that? Or can you have a guard over the window when it's open? I'm not quite sure how many, you know, preventive measures we have here.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, No, you need one only. You either can fit one of the exemptions that are built into the rule, for example, a window that can't open at all, or a window that is permanently fixed so it can't open more than 4 inches. But for those windows that, number one, are required to have the fall prevention devices, and number two, in which the window is functional, is openable, you essentially have a choice of two options. Either the window guards, which are bars, literally bars spaced 4 inches apart, that you put all up and down the window. I'm assuming that most condo owners and apartment renters, for example, would not prefer that because it would include all windows that don't meet the exemption, whether there are children in the household or not, whether it's all adults. And if the bars go up and down the whole window, it's not a very attractive appearance. I mean, it's sort of like in a jail cell. I mean, if all your windows are covered with these bars. So I'm assuming that most builders would probably use the window control devices, which is a second option. Just a latch that you open up and then slide the window all the way up, and then it clicks back into lock position when you lower it. As far as I know, but this is secondhand information, as far as I know, there are not approved screens in the building code. There may be used in other contexts, but that's my information. So you would use one or the other.
So on that point, Mr. Chair.
Saltzman.
If I have a window, if I move into an apartment or I have an apartment and I put these window guards on them, and so I believe that I have a safe window if I have a young child in the room, and it's open 4 inches, and then somebody opens it all the way, or it's a warm day and a parent opens the window all the day, you know, all the way, aren't we back where we were before in terms of a child could crawl up in a bed and fall out the window? I'm not quite sure if we've, you know, provided a false sense of security here, if you can have one or the other. And I think it goes back to, and this was my concern all along, is I really appreciate Senator Berglund's, you know, concern on this. It's a tragedy. And certainly there's been some good discussion of how we do this, but is there this false sense of security? Are we saying that we're going to be able to protect these children when beds are pushed up next to windows? That's where my kids used to sleep, and I did have a bar on that window because I had to keep the windows open. Where are we at with this in terms of a false sense of security? Because I'm kind of hearing this where you can open the window even though it has the guard on it, and we're right back where we were before.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, I think a couple of things. First of all, we now recently have developed two national standards, some with openable guards and some with not. And some windows in apartments are required by law to be openable because they're mandated emergency egress windows. The other situation is where you do have, say, a window safety control device that would allow the window to open. At that point, the parent has been equipped with all the mechanical device that the parent needs. Obviously, ultimately, parents do have to be responsible and to watch their children. We all do as parents. So the parent is equipped. It's like a lock on a door. It's like 100 things in a department. You have the ability now to engage the mechanism that's made available to you. And ultimately, the parent would have the duty to not throw the window open and then leave the child alone in the room with the window open, you know, wide open and nothing, no guard in place.
Right.
So all right.
That point, just I guess that is my point, Mr. Chair, is that there are some pieces here to be able that there is sort of a that the parent or the adult in the home has had to do something to open the window all the way up. But after that, how far do we go in trying to prevent these accidents? When is there a false sense of security if people continue to put a dresser or a bed next to a window and open it all the way? So that's, I guess, my point is it feels that we've done some good work here, but at what point can we protect children when there are adults that may not be using, you know, the judgment?
All right, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, all we're trying to do is get the 42 inches in here. That's what the committee recommended. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's what we should do. Windows that are only 22 inches off the ground, you can have a parent be in the same room, turn their head for a minute and have a toddler crawl over there and be out that window before mm-hmm. a responsible parent can do a thing about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else in the audience wish to be heard? Sir, then we're going to, we heard this last year, we heard it today, so we're ready to move on, but you can get
I just wanted to say something. Mr. Horner was on that committee, and all along he wanted to make it 24 inches. But the will of that committee that he was on voted. There was not two recommendations. There was one recommendation. That committee voted specifically, and it was an overwhelming vote that Mr. Horner may have descended from. I don't remember, but it was an overwhelming vote to make it 42 inches, not 24 inches. The people you've heard today in opposition to that were people that may have voted against that, but the overwhelming number of people there, all those officials that they talked about, voted to make it 42 inches. Thank you.
And that's what the amendment changes it from 48 to 42, is that correct?
From 22.
Okay, do we have a motion to move the Senate file 2911 as amended to... Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 2911 has been that be recommended to pass. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Could we have a division?
Could I have a division? Yeah. All those in favor, raise your hand. Did you count?
Yes.
What is it?
I did, yes. Yeah. What is it then?
Didn't ask for the opposition, did you?
If they had enough on that.
What's the score? Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's revote. All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed. 6-7. On a 5-7 vote, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Senator Tomasoni. We're going to move, if we can, a little faster because we try not to come back tonight if we don't have to. Senator Tomasoni, modifying contractor continuing education requirements. Paulsman?
I do.
I think I'm going to talk to them.
It's for greater news.
We have to do a delete all first. Mr. Chairman, we have a delete all amendment, an 810 delete all amendment first. Put the bill in the shape that we'd like it to be in.
Okay, I thought that we'll do that for Senator Tomasoni to move the and the amendment's in the packet already, so we'll move the amendment by Tomasoni. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevail. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2944 is a continuing education for residential building contractor reform bill, and basically seeks to clarify and increase the standards for requiring continuing education credit for residential building contractors who are licensed in Minnesota. And I will let my witness explain the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Hello again.
Hello. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni and the committee. Again, my name is Karen Lanier, L-I-N-N-E-R. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. I'm the Director of Codes and Research there, and I'm also the sponsor for education for the Builder Association of Minnesota and help our local associations as well with their education courses for contractors. Very briefly, I want to tell you what this bill does not do. It does not change what the department does in terms of qualifying the content for what is taught to residential contractors. What it does do is make that process more transparent. It also makes it easier for the department for...
Let me ask, has this been worked out and is there an opposition to this?
We have a letter of support from the Department of Labor and Industry. We worked quite hard with them to address all their issues.
But
we
had all the people involved, the instructors, the contractors, remodelers, and everybody, they're all aware of this?
Yes. We put on the courses for the contractors and remodelers, so we're one of the sponsors in the states. And we also have the support of the Association of Minnesota Building Officials as well.
I'm trying to cut it.
I'm sorry, sir?
Trying to shorten this up if we possibly can. Certainly don't want to exclude. Okay, go ahead.
Absolutely. The biggest change that you'll see is that it allows internet education courses that are qualified through a third party, and then also the content is approved through the department to allow them, residential building contractors, to get credit through internet education courses, like are done with many professions in Minnesota, architects, doctors, and others. So that's the biggest change. It also has a lot of cleanup language because this used to be a rule in Department of Commerce, then it was moved to the Department of Labor and Industry, and they have recently upgraded that it becomes a two-year cycle for residential contractors to get their licensure. So this bill cleans up that as well and aligns it with that.
Senator,
one other change, it allows...
Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask about the fee, if somebody could talk about the doubling of the fees and if that's been agreed upon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I'd be happy to address that. We proposed $20 just because this hasn't been raised for a very, very long time, and we know there's a lot of administrative work that goes through this. There's also a lot of providers that provide continuing education courses for the for remodelers and home builders. So we talked about it with Department of Labor and Industry. We were the ones that proposed the $10 fee increase per credit hour.
So the Builders Association agrees with the fee. Okay, that's good to know. Good question. Is there anything, anybody in the audience opposed to what continuing education changes? Senator Tomasoni.
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't know of any, but if that's the case, I'll move Senate File 2944 as amended to be recommended to pass.
Okay, is that all right with the committee? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Scheid, do you ready with your municipal enforcement of state building code for persons with disabilities? Senate File 1524.
Mr. Chairman and members, excuse me, I do have an amendment, an A1 amendment, that I'd like to offer as an author's amendment.
Maybe you could explain it just a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, the department, Dolly, did have a couple of concerns, a couple of areas where they thought we could improve the bill, and this addresses those two areas. One, this has to do with enforcement of accessibility requirements in the building code. And we have evidence that that is not being strictly enforced, and it is required. Even if a municipality hasn't enacted the state building code, they're still required to have accessibility in structural renovations or new construction. And so I think Ms. Imdyke, it's Imdyke Cross, is it right now? Ms. Imdyke Cross will tell you about some of those instances. But that's what the bill addresses, and this addresses, I don't want to say it's the only two concerns the department had. I think it's the two areas that I've seen identified, and it does address those.
Okay, on the A1 amendment, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Schein.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, this, I think that it's pretty clear that this, the intent of this bill is already in statute. I mean, it's been over 40 years that newly constructed buildings and existing buildings that have structural renovation or rehabilitation have to comply with accessibility requirements for people with disabilities. Today we find that, I think it's particularly in rural areas of the state, that some small municipalities are not enforcing the accessibility requirements of the building code. And this makes it clear of what's required of all those municipalities throughout the state. As I said earlier, cities that have not adopted the state building code are still required to enforce the accessibility requirements. And as we are aging and as a population, and of course for people with disabilities, I mean, it's more important than ever, I think, that access is provided. So this bill offers options for how municipalities could enforce the building code, and I want to enumerate those for you. excuse me. I want to say I have something here that will... It's a little easier than reading the actual bill, but maybe I'm going to have to do that. I think I left my notes at my place. If you go to page 3 of the bill, it says that that municipalities that have not adopted the state building code, and you know they're still required to enforce the requirements for persons with disabilities, they can either enter into a joint powers agreement with another municipality that has adopted it. They can contract with an individual who's certified under 326B, and they also could hire or train their own staff. And I think I saw someplace, I must have a note someplace, that you can provide that, you can get that training for about $100.
That is correct.
About $100 a year. So that that's possible. And so that's what the amendment added, that third option. Okay, so that amendment actually is on page 3 and in that subdivision 2 paragraph. So it adds they could hire or train their own staff. And then the significant language down in subdivision 4, because it says if the commissioner determines that they're not that a municipality isn't properly administering and enforcing those requirements, that they can have a state building official or another building official, certified building official, undertake to do that. And they will tell the municipality that they're doing it, and then they charge the fees. And instead of saying on line 319, as we do in the bill, that they're going to determine the fees, there's already a statutory reference to fees that state agencies may charge. And so the amendment references that. It's 326B.153. And I think I would ask Ms. Imdike Cross to speak to the bill. And
so thank you. If you would identify yourself for the record, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Margo Imdike Cross. I'm an accessibility specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And we're here today in support of this bill. In fact, we strongly, strongly support this bill. And thanks, Senator Scheid, for introducing it. This bill clarifies what's already in statute. It really does. And as Senator Scheid indicated, state law has required for over 40 years that newly constructed buildings and existing buildings that were structurally renovated comply with the accessibility requirements for people with disabilities. And cities that have not adopted the state building code are still required to enforce the accessibility provisions. Unfortunately, this is not happening. And even though requirements have been on the books for decades, you can still find example after example of newly constructed or structurally renovated buildings in the state, such as restaurants, motels, resorts, and other businesses that fail to comply with the Access Code. I was recently contacted by the Center for Independent Living from East Grand Forks, and they provided me with a snapshot of what's going on in that area of the state, and that's just reflective of what's going on around the entire state. Recently, a resort added an inaccessible cabin in Zirkle, Minnesota. There was a cafe, an addition to a cafe in Neillsville, Minnesota, that was inaccessible. Remodeling an addition to a cafe in Climax, Minnesota. A parking lot that was provided for a grocery store in Bagley, Minnesota, did not provide any accessible parking, and we find that all over the state is newly constructed or structurally renovated buildings that are supposed to be open to the public, all of the public, but not accessible to people with disabilities because they've failed to enforce the accessibility provisions. And so in order to address this, the Department of Labor and Industry in 1994 created a cost-efficient way for small communities to enforce the code. They created what we call the accessibility specialist, which is a subcategory of the building official, which specifically allows for the review and administration of the accessibility requirements of the code. Cities can have somebody on staff, and trust me, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. I'm an accessibility specialist, okay? Okay. And I'm not a rocket scientist. Cities can have somebody on staff certified and receive ongoing training for less than $100 a year. Somebody on staff, be it the guy who, you know, that runs the snowplow in Brewton, Minnesota, or, you know, the maintenance guy, or the secretary. People can go get trained for less than $100 a year on how to administer, how to provide for review and administer the code. There is a cost-efficient way to make this happen. The disability and aging communities are demanding this. It's been 40 years. We're still waiting, but we're getting more and more complaints all the time because as our society ages, more and more people need this access. It's not just people in chairs. It's mom and dad and grandpa and folks that are getting out there and trying to, you know, go to the resorts and go to the restaurants. And you know, one of the most distressing phone calls I think I ever got was from an elderly couple where the woman went to the accessible bathroom. They went to the restaurant because they thought it was accessible. It was relatively new. And it was the standard toilet of 15 inches. And the accessible toilet needs to be between 17 and 19, right? Well, she got down on the toilet. She couldn't get up. She sat there for 45 minutes. Her husband was in a panic. He didn't know what to do. But she sat there for 45 minutes thinking that, you know, no grab bars. This is happening today in 2010. So we want this to change. The Department of Labor and Industry has created a cost-effective way to make it happen. And now we just need to get that message out there to the small communities in Minnesota that, yes, you do have an obligation. You should have been enforcing the code all along, and now we have a cost-effective way to make that happen. Thank you. We urge your support. Thank you.
Darren, thank you very much. I think a very good point of cost efficiency, because it's better to do it right the first time.
That's right.
Then have to go back and redo it. We've seen that with some other pieces in our education community with our charter schools. Let's do them right the first time around with some of our codes. Is there anyone else here to testify? Do you think Senator Shai?
Sure, I don't know.
And a question from Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Gross. Just a couple questions, especially on the line, page 3, line 16, where the commissioner will notify the affected municipality in writing immediately upon making the determination. And then down to line 19, where it says it'll charge a fee. What's the approximate time that they will give the municipality to either go back and redo what they need to do, or is it immediate fine upon notification?
Come to wait. Yeah.
There, and Mr. Joachim appears to be coming up to the microphone.
To
Mr. Joachim.
Madam Chair, Senators, our normal process is if we find a violation, we give the community, the city, county, whatever it is, the opportunity to make the corrections, and ensure that the accessibility is done correctly. If they don't, generally it's a couple of warnings, and generally they do, but in some cases they don't, then we'd have to take our procedures, which we do have enforcement procedures, which we can fine them up to $10,000 a day, and that usually encourages compliance. So what we generally do is if the compliance for the construction is a couple thousand dollars, the contractor is also involved in this process, so we use our penalty system as a tool to say, please get it done, you're required to do it. But in any instance with the cities, we always give them an opportunity to, our cities and or counties, the opportunity to make corrections.
Okay, Ms. Manager.
And a follow-up from Senator Rosen.
Please, thank you. The other question I had was, this is all for public buildings, yeah. I assume. And how many municipalities do you know that have not followed or adopted the state building code? Do you have a run on that?
Madam Chair, Senator, currently in Minnesota, we have 854 cities. We have around 520 cities that administer the code. We have 22 counties that administer the code countywide. And I believe we have 210 townships that administer our state building code. And that changes monthly. Most of the cities over 2,500 population administer the code. I think we have two that are over 2,500 that currently are not administering the state building code. So most of these are small cities, rural counties, where there isn't any, and we have one county that doesn't have a city that's administering the code because they don't have any large cities within the county. But
probably in my district.
But if you look at the other, if you look at the rest of the state of Minnesota, approximately 70 to 75% of the population is in jurisdictions that administer the code, and about 70% of the construction in Minnesota is in jurisdictions that administer the code. So we're talking about 25 to 30% of the population and about the same amount of construction, but in the rural Minnesota areas and counties, there's a lot of these little stores and little shopping centers that go in that do not have accessible entrances, and with the aging population, and my mother, we always obtained the services of a wheelchair to provide her because she's in her walker and she can't go a lot of different places. Well, if we can't get into a lot of these places when we're up north on our vacation, we can't go into some of the antique stores that you would like to visit. So it is becoming an issue more and more as more and more people are vacationing throughout the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
And just to follow up again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I think this is a very valid bill, Senator Scheid, and I would like to see that this issue is covered, but just a cautionary note that I hope it's not a money generator for the department to go in and find these communities that to give them a little room to maneuver. They should know that they have to follow code, and then I think you make a very valid point that the population is aging and we need to make sure that the accessibility issues are taken care of, but I just don't want to make – I just want to be careful about them getting hammered constantly. So,
Madam Chair, Senator, we have six regional code officials that administer and inspect all the schools and hospitals throughout the state of Minnesota, and mostly in the rural Minnesota because we don't have communities that administer the state building code for those types of facilities. So we have an opportunity to visit with these little communities quite often if we get a complaint. So if we get a complaint, we'll go visit with the community and say, this is your responsibility, your zoning administrator, your public works person. Somebody in your city can go to our training program, pay the $100 fee to go through our training, get certified. Our regional staff can assist them in the plan reviews and the inspections until they get their feet wet and get a little understanding what they really need to be looking at. We've tried to give them opportunity over the years. They just haven't. This kind of puts a little more push into it that here's what they should be doing.
Thank you very much. And Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Joachim, or maybe Senator Scheid, just getting ready to answer constituents who, because of the list, number of them are in my legislative district. The change from May on page 2 to shall in the new language on line 3, I'm understanding from the testimony that this has been in place for 40 years, but a municipality may is the way it read before. Who was the default enforcer prior to this, and what is the change that's going to occur to these municipalities with the change from May to shall?
Madam Chair.
To Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Senator Squay, could you just give me the reference again? I'm sorry.
Page 2, line 23, it says the building code may, the municipality may enforce. Now on page 3, line 4, it's the building code shall, the municipality shall enforce. And so what was the default enforcement before, and what is the impact of the municipality of the change from may to shall?
Madam Chair, I think that the may has to do with the opportunity to do it one of two ways. I think that has to do with they may enforce it by entering into a joint powers agreement or contracting for enforcement with somebody certified under 326B. We still have the same options. Thank you. Same options, but we've added a third one, actually, with the amendment, because they could also have somebody on staff who could become certified to do this. So I think that they were required before to enforce it. That I don't think that may really gave them an option to whether or not to enforce. I guess we need to see more of the statute to know that. Maybe Mr. Joachim can speak to that, because I think that really is just about how they may enforce, but they shall enforce.
So, Mr. Joachim?
Madam Chair, Senator Squay, the language has always stated that they are responsible to administer the accessibility code. We have certain codes that are statewide responsible: electrical code, accessibility code, elevator code, boiler, high-pressure piping. Those are all mandated codes that have to be applied by the municipal jurisdictions. The state building code has the voluntary option after 1977, I believe it was, when it came in. And so this hasn't changed that. Our procedures will be identical to what we did prior to this. If we had a complaint on an accessibility issue prior to this language, we would go out and investigate. If we found a problem that did not comply to the accessibility code, then we would inform the jurisdiction and inform the construction project that here's what needed to be done to correct the project and get the project corrected.
So also, Senator Scoy, on line 2.33, if you will look, that in effect, a statutory or a home rule charter state that does not have in effect an ordinance adopting is responsible for enforcement. So Mr. Fuller has pointed that out to me.
So, Madam Chair, and from what I'm hearing, there's no difference in the practicality between the may and the shall. Why are we changing it? Why don't we leave the words the way they were? I mean, otherwise, all the words on those two paragraphs are pretty much exactly the same as far as I can tell.
So, Senator Scheid, or?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I think, I don't know if you would call it current statute ambiguous or not, but there might be some ambiguity in that may, because, and Senator Saltzman's right, down at the bottom of page 2, it already says that they are responsible. It doesn't use shall or must. It just says a statutory or home rule charter that doesn't have an ordinance with the state building code is responsible for enforcement within the city of those requirements for persons with disabilities.
I think I found, Madam Chair, I think I found, as I read further here, the municipalities may enforce, and if they choose not to, the county is responsible.
Okay, Senator Scott.
What we're doing now is taking that away and requiring the municipalities be responsible.
Through either of the, or through these three different methods of how they can implement it.
You know, I'm sympathetic to the effort here, but some of these communities are really small, and, you know, you talk about a secretary, they don't even have that. And, you know, I've just been reviewing some runs.
We did.
What's happening with proposals for these communities. And one of the things that I've been trying to tell folks as I went around my district is the state was going to try not to add a lot more to their plate at this time. And so is there any way we could, for these small communities that count on the county to do their zoning, and that we could leave this in place, that the county would have to do this, as opposed to some of these small communities? I mean, Zirkle, yeah, it's a name of a town, but if you've ever driven through Zirkle, there might be a building there. I mean, there might be. I guess there is I don't even know if it's a store. And so what are we going to ask the community of Zirkle to do?
Madam Chair, I think it was a resort in Zirkle. But, Madam Chair, I don't think we're changing that. I understand you're saying that about Shell, and we're still leaving the county there, but where they're going to enforce, they shall, when they haven't adopted the code, then they shall enforce it by doing one of these three things. And I think that that's probably the counties may fit into that one. Am I correct, Mr. Joachim?
Madam Chair, Senator, the definition of municipality is city, county, town, I believe it is, and or state for public buildings.
And so, Madam Chair, Mr. Joachim, so
excuse me.
As this goes along, I just want to be clear that a municipality, by the vote of their governing board, can decide not to adopt the state building code, in which place then the county would become the responsible jurisdiction.
So essentially, right. Please, Mr. Joachim, if you could clarify that.
Madam Chair, Senator, I need to verify what the existing language, if it's still in there, that
it's,
I don't know,
stricken,
if we have all
but
of
you
it
can
here.
Read it.
Which is on lines 2.22.
This is what we took out, and then we replaced it here, but we've added the third option.
Madam Chair, I wonder if we could ask legal counsel to the. The original statute had a section in it that said if the city wasn't administering the accessibility code, then the county was responsible. I don't see if that's still in the law. Is that still in here?
Yeah. Yes.
I think if you read, Madam Chair, Mr. Joachim, I think if it's on page 3, line 1.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Madam Chair, we found it. Yep.
Okay.
So in all others where there's no ordinance in effect adopting the state building code, the county is responsible for enforcement of the state building code requirements if the city isn't doing it. So,
okay.
So yes.
So we still have that covered, Senator Skoy, it appears. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bearing with me. I'm just preparing myself for questions.
But it's better to work this out and understand the bill at this point. Is there anyone else here, Senator Scheid, that wants
Madam
to
Chair?
Testify?
Thank you. There may be somebody representing small cities, so, and I
okay.
think.
Madam Chair, Dave Engstrom, I'm the director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities and have been following this bill, and we are in support of the bill with the amendment. We did have some concerns which have been addressed. One of the concerns we have is there are not building officials in every municipality. There are many, as Senator Skoy has pointed out, many, many small towns. They do not they're under 2,500 people. They're not required to have the building code in place. They do not normally enforce the ordinance. The change on 3.8, which would allow hiring or training their own staff, we've had a lot of discussions about training city clerks, training a few people in certain regions that could go around. These are not full-fledged building officials, but they are people who could review plans and look for the accessibility standards. And so naturally we're concerned about costs and unfunded mandates to small cities, but it's not going to get any better, and we need to get this done now.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Engstrom. Anyone else who would like to testify? Are we ready to move the bill? And I believe the bill goes to the floor. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I think that's true. So I'd move that Senate File 1524, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Is there any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Chair and
committee,
thank
you very
you.
Much, Senator Scheid. Next on our agenda, we're going to skip Senator Bonoff's bill. We have Senate File 2874, and Senator Pogemiller, we're delighted to have you here today with your state government streamlining legislation. We've had a lot of discussion this year about some of the things we could do with reform and efficiencies, and I believe you have an author's amendment, Senator Pogemiller.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's a delete everything, and I think it's based on a lot of input from people, so if the committee would adopt that, then you'd have
And Senator Skoy, would you move the A3 amendment? And on the A3 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails. So we are with the A3 amendment. And Senator Pogamiller, welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. members, be kind. This is my first bill this session, maybe my only bill this session. So, members, what this bill is, and it's something that has been surfaced and worked around over the last few years, is basically employee-empowered reorganization of government. We know from the private sector that there absolutely has to be massive productivity enhancements for what we're doing in government in terms of use of technology, in terms of at what level of employee decisions are made. And it's basically been a flattening out of organizations and a decentralization of power. That's basically what's gone on in the private sector as technology is enhanced. In government, we have a hard time moving to that because our organizations are built to last. And they last. And every new governors come in and new governors try to alter that pattern and get caught up in struggles between finance committees and departments and commissioners that make it pretty hard to move the ball during their short time in office. And so what this is an attempt to place the task of restructuring these organizations in the hands of the people who are going to be there and are there for the long haul, and that is the managers and the employees of the agencies. And to make that work, you have to make sure that people know they're not wasting their time doing it. They need to know that there is going to be an outcome. So you have to have some stakes here that people kind of go, all right, it is worth my effort, so that they're willing to take some risks. But you also need to do it in a way where you don't create such fear in the organizations that people are fetally retract and are unable to make suggestions for changing the way they do their work that could increase productivity and improve services. So the ideas in this bill are premised on a lot of the research and discussion, both in the public and private sector, of how you create change in organizations. And it is fundamentally premised on the notion that real change only takes place if the people doing the work create the change. IBM did this. All large organizations do this. And so it's not as simple as the CEO or the governor divining the change. It just doesn't happen that way because we all know we have jobs in the private sector where you just basically wait management out. You're going to be there longer than they are, and you just survive. And then that starts to kind of drive down the excitement for innovation and change in the organization. So what this bill does, it's real simple. It sets in place several groups that will design or discuss how to change the organization, creates a time certain for when that reorganization will take place, and then hopefully puts in place the mechanism where the legislature and the governor can react quick enough to make it happen so that people don't lose interest. I'll walk through the bill real quick. And I should just mention it deals with Deed and Dolly. It could be other departments, but these are the two that I selected, and the reason is because they both have something to do with job creation or employment in our state. And it seems like whatever those two departments are doing should be done in a way that is focused totally on how do we enhance the long-term economic sustainability of the state. I think some charts are being passed out on the current organizational structure of the two departments. They're very complex organizations, about 1,600 employees at Deed, a budget of $736 million, mostly federal money. That's a tip-off that we probably have accountability issues there and productivity issues, because if it's somebody else's money, you probably don't spend as much time figuring out if you're spending it wisely. Only about $90 million out of their budget is state money. Most of it is federal money. Dolly, Department of Labor and Industry, has got about 500 employees, so about a third of the size. It's been growing, but mostly due to federal funds again. It's got about a $270 million budget. Workers' comp is over $200 million of that. So that's a special fund funded by employers that, again, raises a red flag of accountability because it's somebody else's money. There have been numerous, I'm not going to go through the legislative auditors, there's been numerous audits in the last few years of these two agencies. And all these audits find challenges. So the audits didn't say these were terrible departments, they should be eliminated, it's a disaster. That's not what they say, but they do say goals are not focused, compliance measures are slow, departments not fulfilling management responsibilities, control financial controls for overpayment, lack of a comprehensive security management program on information technology, accountability for workforce programs is not as strong as it needs to be, monitoring of providers is inconsistent. So again, I only point those out as there are challenges there. The departments are working on those. The current commissioners have reacted to many of those criticisms. But it's a task that is really hard when you're not there as long as all the employees. So what the bill does, just going through it quickly. Section 1 and Section 2 set out the overall goals and outcomes that we expect out of these agencies. And they're simple things. The goals are very global. We expect sustainable economic development for our state. Not that this organization can create that, but that's what they're there for. They're there to assist sustainable economic development. We want growth for our economy. We want great efficiency and transparency. We need to meet the competitive global dynamic environment. There needs to be coordination with post-secondary institutions. So those are kind of big-picture goals. That is not the sole responsibility of these agencies, but they exist to make those things better in our state. Section 2 is more specific about specific outcomes that we do expect out of these agencies. Citizen access that's pertinent and understandable. Decentralization that offers one-stop opportunities for citizens. Flattening of the interorganizations. Identification and continual identification and capturing of cost savings. Flexibility to coordinate with local governments or other service providers, both nonprofits and for-profits in these areas. Increased use of performance-based employment measures. Base things on performance. If someone actually gets a job, that should measure that you've accomplished something. If all we've done is move paper around and no one's gotten a job, we're probably not accomplishing what we'd like to accomplish. Reduce the number of executive administrators. That, again, reporting directly to the governor. That's based on many, many studies over the years. Numerous gubernatorial commissions have said, cut down the number of direct reports to the governor. And we ebb and flow on that. But every time we keep kind of growing and then trying to shrink. So that's something that has to do with just a general thrust. Commitment to adequate staff development so that the workers in these agencies are in a position to have best practices for whatever they're trying to accomplish. And then some obvious ones, increased employment, reduction in labor shortages, increased business development support, reduced workforce injuries, identifying emerging sectors of the economy where we should be focusing. And finally, priority-based budgeting. Those are the goals or outcomes that we want, and set in place three groups immediately. Group one, this is on page 2, line 2.27, 10 to 15 people, managers, put together a group of 10 to 15 managers in these agencies that can start to problem solve and work with each other to talk about how would we do this better, brainstorm. What would we do if we were just thinking about how this should all be set up, how would we do it? At the same time, a group of employees would gather and meet, and they would be the line workers that are part of the exclusive bargaining organizations, and they would do the same thing. They would start to blue sky, how could we make this better? What would be a good way to reorganize everything? Then finally, a third group of up to 10 people appointed by legislature that are kind of outside citizen experts, some labor union people, some business people, higher ed people. There's a list there. An attorney who works in the workers' comp area, some other types of people that could have some thoughts about the way the system's working now and how they think it could be better. These folks would start to work, and then by October 1st of this year, we would set up a second group that is a subgroup of those three groups that would now cross ideas between the managers, the employees, and the outside experts. That would be subgroups of those three groups. Same people, just fewer of them, and now they're collaborating together. This is what you guys thought of as managers. Here's what we thought of as employees. And look for commonalities or things that might make some sense. That group also then would simultaneously try to figure out what other levels of government are doing to see, and they could use, they would have legislative staff provided to help them if they needed that. Parallel to that, Section 4, an Employee Participation Committee, on July 1st, this is the serious committee now. This is not the blue sky committee. This is the committee that says, okay, based on what these other people are talking about, how would we actually do that? And they would identify tasks and steps to accomplish that reorganization. And they would develop detailed plans to retrain employees, guide implementation of a reorganization, and they would report all that by January 15th to the next legislature and the next governor to say, we're good to go. Here's the enacting legislation that we need to get this done, and here's the kind of budget we need to get this done. So the agencies then would be abolished at that point, assuming a law passes that replaces them, either one agency or multiple groups or whatever. So there's not a cliff here. We're not going to eliminate agencies and assume they're not going to be there. But the cliff is we're dead serious about this. The legislature is going to eliminate these agencies, and we want something to replace it. The governor, is Section 6, the governor would work all of this into his or her budget as to how would you now accommodate all this. It presumably will have a reduction. There'll be some flattening in the organizations. There'll be a reduction in managerial positions. And then finally, assuming that that all came together through the legislative session, you would have an elimination of those agencies and hopefully replaced by a more an organization better prepared to deal with the tasks that we're focused on in Sections 1 and 2. So that's the crux of the bill. In addition now, I've added, and this was not in the draft that I gave members yesterday, but when it was suggested to me, I thought, you know, why don't I put that in there and run that up the flagpole and see what members think of that. This is a simple thing that Article 2, so it's not fundamental to the bill, but I think it's a pretty good idea. We hear often that there's too much contracting out, and what this puts in place is it resolves that argument. It just says, look, if it's less expensive to contract out and it gets better service, how can we be against that? If, on the other hand, though, it actually is not less expensive and does not get our better service, then we maybe shouldn't be doing that. So all that language does is set up a way to resolve that argument that, you know, labor always says contracting's bad, and new managers always say contracting out is good. Why don't we just put an end to the debate, measure it, and figure out if it's good or bad in particular instances, because in some instances it is a good idea. In other instances it may not be. That's the bill, members. And again, Article 2 is not fundamental to the bill I started with here, but I do think it's a pretty good idea. And let me open it up for discussion and questions.
So thank you very much, Senator Pilgrim-Miller. I do want to note that on line 5.32, we just have a minor correction we'd like to maybe amend. On line 5.32, where it says under Section 3, that should be under Section 4, paragraph C. So if Senator Shy would like to move that motion to make that correction.
Madam Chair, I will.
And all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, I do have some brief testimony to surprise of many members, I think. Both our major labor organizations in the state that deal with public employees do support this approach. You know, it's based on principles that they have advocated nationally. And so brief hearing from AFSCME and MAPE would be, I think, timely right now.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
And excuse me, Senator Bach has a question.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, my question is, I remember when we did the DES, the DTED merger, must be approaching 10 years ago now, I suppose. One of the concerns from the some of the advocacy groups in the tourism community was that the little Department of Tourism was going to get totally lost in this bigger, because it had used to be under DTED, was going to get lost in this great big new agency. And so an idea was floated, and I actually ended up carrying a bill creating Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, and it actually is under the executive branch, under the governor. And it seems like it's worked pretty well. But I think there were some legitimate fears there that the whole tourism was going to get lost. And the other thing that I remember we talked about, I'm afraid, has come true. And it was the issue that when we did that earlier merger, we were going to put the employees from DTED, which were about 250 people, in with DES, which were about 2,000 people, that somehow our economic development efforts would get lost. Unfortunately, I think that's what's happened. Our economic development efforts, when they went into the larger agency of DES, just overshadowed the work that DTED had been doing. And what I'm a little worried about is now putting all three of these, would have been three departments together, are we going to dilute our economic development efforts even further when we add all these labor and industry people in now? And what can we do to make sure that our economic development efforts are emphasized, I think, because it's certainly, I think the first merger between DTED and DES hasn't served the state well, hasn't served our economy well. We haven't been growing personal income like I think most of us want to. Senator Pokemon, any thoughts about how we can create more emphasis on the economic development side in this new, larger department?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I don't know that answer, because the people who work in these areas, they're going to tell us what's going to work. What I can tell you is, from a legislative point of view, I think Sections 1 and 2 are the most important. Because in there, we define what we expect with these 2,000 or 3,000 employees. And the managers and workers in those agencies, that's what we're looking for. And it seems to me that if legislators and governor focus on what we want as outcomes or results from this employment of our state employees, we're more likely to have things focused on that we want focused on. I do know that in all kinds of organizations, big or small, you can make them effective if people are focused on the right things. And I don't predispose that I know how best to do the work these people are doing. What I do know, as a policymaker, is that we're not doing as well as we need to do. And so I'm trying to say that in a way as I'm not at all criticizing the current agencies. I'm just saying I just don't think they're as good as they have to be. And we just need to figure out a way to do it better.
Well, you know, on that point, Senator Pogueviller, on Monday we heard a bill in here that sort of goes in a little bit of a different direction, but you know, it does talk about a new structure. Was when we had this group that represented the business community, that represented the University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, and looked at what are we doing within science and technology, economic development, their response was, we absolutely have to have a separate commission or authority that drives economic development. So I'm just saying that I would like to see somehow incorporate into this, that how do we have something – but how do we really engage our business community? So I am an author on this bill, a co-author, and so I think just to, again, make sure that all those voices are heard, because we do talk about the collaboration and not losing that. So I think within this structure there's an opportunity to do that, but we don't want to lose that vital job growth. So, Senator Bach?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Pogemeyer, this issue is not for this committee, but I don't serve on the finance division, so I won't get another bite at this, but on page 5, lines 5.8 and 5.9, on 5.8 and 5.9, we say that the governor in his proposed budget must submit a budget to the legislature that is the amount that was appropriated in 10 and 11 plus inflation. I think considering our budget circumstances, the next governor is going to probably propose a budget that is somewhat smaller. I certainly don't think it's going to have inflation added to it. So just something, I think, to think about it. I mean, that makes no recognition for any unallotments that have happened, or I think it's just a little bit optimistic that we're somehow going to put inflation into any budget proposal for the next governor, considering what the economic circumstances. So just something for the Finance Committee to
to consider.
I'm sure that's a good point.
So we have some guests here today. If you'd like to begin and just introduce yourself for the record. Oh, excuse me, Senator Skoy. I'm sorry. Let's get some more questions here.
Thank you,
Senator
Skoy. Senator Pogemiller, kind of along the lines of what Senator Saltzman was talking about, you know, I was reading here in Section 2, and, you know, I agree with this, increased citizen access, better citizen representation. I don't remember when it was, but the DNR went to regionalize decision-making a number of years ago. So it might have been back under Carlson. I wasn't in the legislature then. But I know that at that time, the public kind of felt left out of what was going on with the decision-making, as there was less ability for them, I guess, to pressure maybe. And I'm not advocating that legislators get involved in this, but currently what happens is the public uses their legislators to affect agencies. And so when this is going forward, I think we really need to pay attention to those points because, you know, in business, as they do decentralized decision-making, you know, they're always kind of focused on the customer because that's where their money's coming from. But government doesn't work that way. And so we've got to figure out some ways to see if we can ensure that this 1 and 2 on Section 2 are really paid attention to, because I understand what you're trying to do, but some kind of assurances in that area, and I think Senator Saltzman talked about that also.
Very good. Senator Bonhoff, did you have a response? More of a statement. Did you have a response, Senator Pogemiller?
Well, I think it depends on the service. I think to the extent that the private sector has decentralized the decision-making to line workers, you've gotten a lot better customer service. You go into a store and that salesperson can make the decision, you get better service. And there are things that we do in government where that absolutely should be taking place. So this issue of centralization versus decentralization is a very complex issue. And it all gets down to who gets to make the decision. And I absolutely don't presume. I mean, I look at these organizations. I don't have enough knowledge to have a clue how to do this. I presume, and the premise of this bill is, the people who do this for a living need to be put into, if they're put in a position where they can think about how to do their job better, I believe we'll get a better job done.
Is that the new model?
But Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pogemiller, thank you for bringing this initiative forward. As you know, I'm a strong supporter of looking at ways to reengineer and reorganize state government. I don't think we're on a sustainable path. I would concur with what Senator Bach said when he pointed to the budget areas, because I think ultimately we're going to have to reduce our budgets, not because of reorganization for reorganization's sake, but because we have a structural deficit and we have to do that. And to Senator Bach's point about a focus on economic development, I like that in Article 1, Number 1 and Number 2 and Number 8 are very strong statements that express a commitment to economic growth and sustainable economic growth. But I would suggest in Section 2 that the outcome that relates to that area doesn't come down until Number 13, increased business development support. And so I don't think that we have a correlated outcome consistent with your strong commitment that you've laid forward in the goals. So I don't have an answer yet, but I'd be happy to work with you on that. I think we want to have our primary outcomes of this reorg be that we have strong business growth in opportunistic areas that we've identified. And one of the things we've talked about on this committee is really the need almost for SWAT teams, where we go out and support an administrative initiative to attract and retain new startups, small business. So I think that section could be stronger, just in the section number 2. And then the last thing is with regard to section number 7, managerial position reductions. I'm not a fan of such micromanagement in terms of telling the governor he or she must reduce the number of deputy commissioners. I would be more inclined to put something here that the governor must adopt an organizational structure that reflects the streamlined reorganization consistent with the task force recommendations. I think that it's a mistake to decide ahead of time that some solution is a reduction in deputy commissioners. I think that based on where this lands, we don't know what that'll look like.
Very good. I think that was some feedback, Senator Bonoff. So maybe we'd yes, like Senator. To start.
Yes, Madam Chair, it was.
With Madam Chair,
she's always liked managers.
Madam Chair, to that.
Yeah, that's Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, to that feedback point of Senator Bonoff's, Senator Pogemiller, the bill matter-of-factly abolishes both Deedon and Dolly. And is there, I mean, what if the committees that make the recommendations come back and say, we think it's good the way it is? Does that end up?
That could work under this, yes.
And then say they came back and said, you know,
we need three agencies.
We need three agencies. Yeah, I mean,
that could work under this, but I'd be surprised. But.
Well, is there flexibility for that in this bill, or are they automatically yes. Abolished and something has to happen?
No, the language is pretty specific that unless the legislature and the governor kind of implement whatever has been suggested here, that you really can't just eliminate the agencies. That's what Section 8 basically says.
Section 8 is the effective.
You got to be realistic. I mean, I don't think it's pretty hard to see how, if you've got 2,000 employees doing something, you could end up in a situation where you're just not going to do those things. Period. I mean, that seems a little. That would be. I don't think that's going to happen.
So let's move forward with the on the testimony and welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Richard Kajewski, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Over the past 2 years, MAPE and its over 12,700 state employees have spent countless hours working to identify waste in government. Through that process, we have worked with legislators and leadership to identify areas where we believe the state of Minnesota could be more efficient. I'd like to thank Senator Pogemiller and the co-authors for his leadership in attempting to streamline government while improving services and economic growth through the proposal of Senate File 2874. The goal of streamlining state agencies is essential to helping resolve another historic deficit facing us this next biennium. MAPE applauds and supports responsible efforts to restructure our state government while continuing to provide efficient and essential services for the citizens of the state. When it comes to restructuring, the question we need to ask ourselves is what can we afford to lose? In all state agencies, MAPE members perform numerous services that directly benefit the public. Determining what we can afford to lose is a critical question to keep in mind when state agencies are being reorganized and the priority of serving the citizens of this state remain. When we think of what vital services should be maintained, a few examples come to my mind. At the Department of Labor and Industry, our members keep workforce safe, they enforce child labor laws, and make sure that people are properly compensated for a hard day's work. At the Department of Employment and Economic Development, MAPE members process unemployment benefits, staff call centers to help people get through the unemployment process and help get people employed through our efforts at the state workforce centers. At both agencies, MAPE members are the IT staff working to provide technological support to ensure the communication systems operate efficiently and effectively. Yet we know that times are changing. Government needs to be looked at to see where there are overlaps, and efficiencies need to be acted upon. This bill allows union employees who do the day-to-day work in these agencies an opportunity to be part of the solution. We welcome that opportunity. We look forward to working with the legislature and the other stakeholders to make sure that government agencies provide the highest quality service to Minnesotans in the most resourceful way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Scheid?
Hi. My name is Elliot Scheid, and I'm the executive director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 state, local, and nonprofit employees in all 87 counties of Minnesota. We also represent specifically over 19,000 state employees here in for the state of Minnesota as our employer. Madam Chair and members, thank you for this opportunity to testify before the committee. I want to thank Senator Pogemiller and the other authors for including us in discussions about how to do this and how to talk about it. I do want to point out to the committee, Madam Chair and members, that we have the 11th leanest workforce in the nation. I'll repeat that. We have the 11th leanest workforce in the nation, state workforce. On average, AFSCME members make $38,000 a year, and we are the ones, along with our brothers and sisters in MAPE and the other unions, that provide critical services that Minnesotans need when they go through when they're going through this recession. People don't have the money to go on expensive vacations, they go to parks. People don't have money to buy books, they go to libraries. People who want to send their children to higher education, send them to state colleges and universities and technical colleges, and hopefully they'll be affordable. We have some principles that we've articulated over the last 20 years. We've always been willing to meet with any employer and sit down, and we embrace change. And we'll go and redesign government to produce the most efficient services that we can. We've had some principles, and I want to articulate those to you because I think those guiding principles, they determine if we're going to support a reorganization or redesign, and we'll tell you why we support this one. First principle, workers will embrace change if they have security. And if you, this starts to sound familiar to you, they come from a great American economist named Demings. They're principles of economic production and reorganization. Workers will embrace change if they have security. And the second principle that ties to that is to drive fear from the workplace. If you expect workers to innovate, nobody, including anyone in this room, is going to just sit here and talk themselves right out of a job, especially in the market that we're in right now. But if you tell somebody that, indeed, you may not have the job you have today, but you will have a job of equal or greater value, and you'll get the opportunity to train and retrain for that job, then you're going to have as many ideas as you can to produce an efficient service. So workers will embrace change if they have security and drive fear from the workplace. Train and retrain workers for new jobs that may come about. In a time of limited resources specifically, but any time generally, you want to move resources to the frontline workers, to the point of contact with the customer or the public. You don't want to have resources sitting somewhere else. You want the resources to move to the point of service to the client or the customer. And along with that particular principle is a fourth principle, flatten the organizational hierarchy. You make the organization more flat, drive resources to the point of service, and you get better economic productivity and better outcomes for folks. You need to, number five, you need to involve frontline workers in change. I mean, who knows how to deliver a service? Should service be redesigned by somebody sitting in some office somewhere who has no idea what's going on in that delivery of service? I applaud Senator Pogamiller's comment before saying, this is not how to redesign and what all these people do is not something that the legislators themselves know how to do, but a process can be created so that the people who do know how to deliver the service, who are working with the public, the businesses, the community on an everyday basis, have that opportunity to talk about how to do that in the most efficient and productive manner possible. So involve the frontline workers. And the last thing, principle, and I think it's very important, if redesign or reinvention is going to be code word or reform for just budget cutting, then don't bother. Don't bother. Because if you're going to a change and redesign service, that may actually require upfront investments to, in fact, create long-term efficiencies. Let me give you just a couple of examples. You know, we can all debate healthcare all day long, I'm sure, and I'm not planning on doing that today. This is complicated enough. But I think we could all agree that unless we get all our docs and our hospitals on electronic medical records and streamline that part of it, we're not going to be able to have any health care reform if we're Democrats, Republicans, Independents, union, or business. We're not going to be able to do it. That's going to take upfront investment to create long-term efficiencies. Computerization, other things like that will create some long-term efficiencies. They may cost some money up front. So those are the principles that we use. Having stated those, we think this legislation, Madam Chair and members, embody those principles and operationalize them in practice, and allow the workers in those agencies to have an opportunity to restructure services in such a way as to afford the customers the best possible service, to produce the services in the most efficient and productive manner, and to get the best efficiencies out of the system. If it's going to save a lot of money or not, I think is a whole different issue. I would tend to agree with former Finance Commissioner John Gunya that I think this is a rather small part of the overall budget piece. But nevertheless, our members, like MAPE members, like every state employee, want to be able to say that we can deliver the services in the most efficient way possible. So that's on the main part of the bill. On the second part of the bill, which is the Taxpayer Accountability Act, we recently, last year, and Senator Murphy was the author in the Senate, passed an important piece of legislation that was passed by the House, signed by the governor, is law today. That allows us to take a look at contracts, to look at the efficiencies, to see are we getting our bang for the buck. Let me give you just one outcome of that. And if you want to get any specifics about this, our state director and our transportation expert, Bob Hilliker, is here with me today who can answer these. But let me give you one example. Through the processes that were created by the Transportation Accountability Act, now the Taxpayer Accountability Act for all state agencies, we discovered that if state employees go out and do striping on a road, it's 8 cents a stripe. If you contract out that same service, it's 31 cents a stripe. Now, which should you be doing in time of economic need particularly? I would suggest to you it's 8 cents a stripe, not 31 cents a stripe. So it's because of that act and the transparency that it created that the department had to actually come up and demonstrate things that we were able to prove that. And so we totally support the Taxpayer Accountability Act. We think it's another way to make sure that governments run most efficiently and that the public has a perception of it. And then finally, I just want to say AFSCME is proud to have participated in a number of redesigns that have fundamentally changed the way we've done business in state government. One, we were involved in the complete transformation of the delivery of developmental disability services, where we went from large regional treatment centers to state-operated community facilities. We supported the closure of large facilities to create state-operated group homes. And we did it because following the principles that are being articulated in Senator Poga Miller's bill, we were able to embrace change because we had security. Workers were able to negotiate a memorandum of understanding. People were trained and retrained for new jobs. Others received enhanced severance, early retirements, ways to get out. And we transformed the entire way we delivered developmental disability services in the state of Minnesota. And secondly, we were involved in the creation of broadbanding in the Department of Transportation. Senator Murphy, again, familiar with this. The TSS series, we were able to broadband a number of classes, redesign the way we deliver a product, and we're doing it more efficiently and with greater utilization of personnel than ever. We're proud of these activities. We want to continue to do those. This bill offers us a way to participate and our members to have a say in the outcome of those services. After all, who's the experts? The people who deliver the services. Thank you.
So let me just ask, both of your organizations are part of the AFL-CIO, correct?
We are.
They're not. So AFSCME is. And I really appreciated your comment, Mr. Seid, about upfront investments, because in this committee and in Senator Thomas Sonny's committee, several bills have been sent regarding, you know, investments and what we need to do to create jobs and help some of our emerging companies. So I really appreciate that, but I have to challenge you that if your parent organization has tried to kill some of those proposals that I have carried that are coming from the business community, and in speaking with them and pulling them together for meetings, they had never even read the bill before they tried to kill it. I found that you're not really maybe listening to the business community very well. So maybe you want to take that back. But I just want to just say that if we're going to have a process of bringing together people to reconstruct a department that is going to deal with job development, I think we all have to feel confident that we're going to listen to the customers. So I just want to just
Madam
share
Chair,
that.
You took advantage of my bill to do your business.
No, I didn't, Mr. Chair, because I think that this bill is all about upfront investments, and I want to be assured that if we move down this road that, you know, we are, you know, bringing these groups together, and we've done a lot of work, this committee, of listening to people who sometimes don't feel that they are listened to very well down here. So we want to make sure that
I'll pass that along to Ms. Knutson.
She's already aware that we want to really make sure that I think it's important that members understand, because you are talking about you want to be part of this process. So we want to make
bet
sure
you Mr. Seid has issues with the AFL-CIO too.
Well, that's fine, but I just think that we talk about upfront investments here, and he brought it up, Mr. Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to say though that AFSCME's record on this is very clear and long. Goes back to the 80s. We have been involved in transformation processes. We're dead serious about it. But we want to be at the table. And we want to be at the table at the front end along with the workers. And and after all, those are the people who know how to deliver change. And
Thank you
we
very
stand
much.
With
no,
that.
I appreciate that. So for I know sure. there will be people who may question if this is the right approach. So I just want to assure them that we're going to be listening to all stakeholders. Any other comments, Senator Murphy, and then Senator Tomassoni?
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. And Madam Chairman, Mr. Seid, you mentioned an author named Deming. He wrote a couple other books about self-directed work teams. And this concept that you're talking about fits into that. You know, the more that I believe that our rank and file take ownership of the job, you know, the customer's going to be very impressed, Senator Saltzman. And I can tell you that as a customer that uses a lot of the services that AFSCME provides out on our roads, I've been very impressed this past year. You know, of course, if our budget was bigger to fill in some of the potholes, I'd be even more impressed.
So would we.
But you can only fill in as many potholes as you have shovels of asphalt. But but Mr. Seid and Mr. Hilliker and Ms. Blau and the department have worked on not only the engineering portion of this agreement that we made, but also all across the spectrum to deliver these services just as cheaply and as quickly as possible. And I think that if that's replicated across the rest of the departments that we have, you know, a lot of good things are going to happen. I do believe that we can get rid of, I shouldn't say get rid of, I think that we could probably downsize our management and let our workers take more control of their jobs.
So, Senator Tomassoni?
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, we had a joint Finance and Tax Committee hearing the other day, and the state economist commented that if you lose a job in the private sector, if you lose a job in the public sector, that they're both equally damaging to the economy. And this is one of the conversations that I've had with Senator Pogemiller about this bill that worries me, is that that I don't know what the outcome of abolishing these agencies will be when it comes to jobs. It is clearly indicating that it would like to reduce the number of managerial positions, which are also jobs, and maybe we don't need all the managerial positions. But what I would like to know from the two witnesses is that if these task forces come back and recommend that we cut state jobs also, regular rank-and-file jobs, are you still going to be in support of this bill? Because I don't really want to see anybody losing their jobs, if you want to know the truth.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni, obviously we don't want anyone to lose their jobs. We already have people losing their jobs. We think that we do have a structural deficit. It's caused by a structural revenue problem, and that the governor needs to tax those who have the ability to pay, the richest people in the state. We're the only people not stepping up in this crisis to sacrifice with the rest of us on how to deal with this. And rather than lay off five workers, we could, you know, maybe increase taxes on those who have the money to pay a little more. And so that's what we think the ultimate solution is. But I think if the workers get together in this task force, and it's a straight-up task force, and they figure out how to deliver services, not only will they try to figure out how to deliver services better, they will find out there are other jobs that now can be done that weren't able to be done well before, and perhaps people will be able to be trained and retrained for that, or else we'll be able to look at the possibility of negotiating, as we did in the development of disability redesign, a memorandum of understanding that allows people to take enhanced severance, early retirement. But I think we'd be willing to let the workers, you know, take the task and try to figure out how to best deliver the service. Obviously, we don't want anybody else to get laid off, and we'd rather have people trained and retrained. We think there's plenty of productive work that needs to be done to continue to make this state great, and it's unfortunate that the governor of the state has decided not to participate in that.
Madam Chair, members, my response, I guess, is rather simple. I'm not in the business of advocating for anybody to lose their job, private or public sector, but I will state that I do believe with the age of the average state worker today, there will be downsizing in these state agencies that can be done without laying people off to the streets. There may not be job growth in state government, but there is going to be retirements and attrition, and there's ways to reorganize without doing it through the layoff process. And I know Mr. Seid talked about early retirement incentives and severance packages and that sort of thing that actually on paper do save the state a substantial amount of money. So, no, I'm not. I wouldn't advocate for the private sector to lose jobs, much less the public sector lose jobs.
And Madam Chair, and the witnesses, we constantly try and do that to people moving on through attrition and whatever the packages are. But what worries me is that if we're actually considering downsizing a couple of agencies and trying to streamline government, that the end results are is that people actually end up losing jobs. And I want to make sure that that you won't be supporting a bill like that in the event that these committees come back and say, you know, we got 1,000 too many people working in these places. Like, I don't think we have room for 1,000 people to be to leave by attrition. And my most important feelings are right now that not only do the agencies deliver the services that they're required to deliver, but that people keep their jobs, because we cannot afford to lose one job in this state. And I think we have to grow jobs. And part of the state government incumbency is to help grow jobs and figure out how to create jobs. And whether they're in the public sector or the private sector, each job is important. And I don't want to see people getting laid off.
Madam Chair.
Senator Polgemiller.
This is one of those instances where I'm going to wish I probably didn't say this, but Senator Tomasoni, our the state government is not a jobs program. The state government is an organization that is there to try to provide the services that the citizens of the state want or expect or ask for through their elected representatives. And so this is just a minor focus difference. I don't think we should take the position that we can never have fewer jobs in state government or in an organization. Our position should be we should provide the best services we can as productively as we can. And if we do that, the assumption in the United States has always been that more people will be working. If we do our job well, more people will be working either in the public or the private sector, and they will be paying more taxes, and we will all be happier for the level of services we're getting. So, Senator Tomasoni, I only challenge your emphasis there. I absolutely don't think it's the right thing to sit there and say we just have to make sure nobody ever – there's always more jobs in the government. I mean, I just don't agree with that. It depends on what we're trying to accomplish. There may be areas that we're working in where we need more jobs. There may be areas that we're working in that no longer make sense for jobs. So I probably regret that. You'll probably talk to me about that. But I think we got to be real careful. Our job is we're representing taxpayers to provide services that they would like for their taxation.
Well, and so, Madam Chair, I just go back to what the state economist said, Senator Polgemiller, that a public job is equally valuable to the taxpayer as a private job.
Absolutely, but it doesn't mean there has to always be more of them.
I did not suggest more. I suggested not losing any. That's what I suggested.
So we would like to try to get through two more bills by 3:00, and I do know there may be some other people here to testify. And Senator Polgemiller, I think this is your first stop. And you will probably have others.
Senator Rest
so
is eagerly
is just waiting
for the bill.
To hear this bill. So are there some other people here you would like to testify, Senator Polgemiller?
I don't have other testifiers. There may be others.
Okay.
I do know we didn't.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? And I see Commissioner Swigum coming forward. So you could stay at the table, Senator Polgemiller, if you'd like to. Okay.
Come on, Harry. Come on.
It would be a wonderful photo
you
opportunity.
Be close.
Boxing Commission.
Bring Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Commissioner, welcome.
Since the bill does address the department, I should first introduce myself. For the record, I'm Steve Swigum, Commissioner of the potentially former Department of Labor and Industry. Madam Chair, from the 30,000-foot level, I think this is a wonderful piece of legislation. From the 30,000-foot level, I think it responds to, as Senator Polgemiller said, what government ought be looking at. Programs for people, jobs, what those support programs are. I would term this bill, members, a game changer. Now, as you know, game changers can either be positive or they can be negative. They can be game changers either way. But I think if we look at this bill, and if done right, I think we're looking at the linking the regulation that is basically done by my department with promotion that is basically done by DEED, Economic Development, and earned support programs that are done by both departments, earned support programs for workers. And I think that an integrated system, streamlined system, certainly can serve better those programs and the citizens of the state of Minnesota. I realize that that the bill has a ways to go at this point, but I think, again, from the 30,000-foot level, it is a very, very positive move. I was encouraged to hear Senator Pogermiller refer to the first two sections of his bill as being the most important sections of the bill. I would think that maybe there are other sections of the bill that maybe take into consideration other interests than just maybe the most important first two sections, those goals, the performance of those programs for the persons, for the workers that it's intended to. Madam Chair, I sit here to tell you that my department will help and will enhance and will encourage, will support the passage of this bill. And we will work with Senator Pogermiller, the legislature, and the governor to make sure that that the focus of the bill is brought forward in the best interest of the state. Just one quick question, one quick other statement at the, as I close, and certainly there are different sections that may be affected in the best interest of the state programs other better than others. But I noticed as Senator Bach was also speaking, and Senator Bach's question about the next budget appropriations. And as you all know, it's always difficult for one legislature to bind another legislature, the succeeding one. It's also difficult for a legislature to bind a succeeding governor because the governor does have abilities to change law in his appropriations and his budgets as well.
Or her.
So I think that the issue that that Senator Bach raised is certainly one that would need to be considered, certainly considered in light of the amendment that we have before us. I found it somewhat ironic to see Section 6, which basically says the appropriation the same as the past plus inflation, right, and then see the new amendment with Section 2 being, or Article 2 being Taxpayer Accountability Act. I found that to be a bit ironic, but maybe that was just from my perception. But I fully support the bill, and I think from the 30,000-foot level, it can best serve the interests of the state.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Oh, I'm really nervous.
What I hear, I just walked in.
You know, well, you know, it always... Like, change is very difficult. And Senator Pogermiller, I think one of the things you said was about the need for massive productivity enhancement. I think that's those are three very important words, of important phrase to describe what we need to do as a legislature. That's, I think, what the public is looking for. So are there other people who would like to testify? If not, Senator Bonoff, would you like to move Senate File 2874 as amended to the State and Local Government Committee, and we'll have discussion after that motion.
So moved.
Further discussion, Senator Pogermiller, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Members, I've written down notes on your comments. Please feel free to let me know what changes you think make sense, and I'll incorporate them if I can.
Very good. Thank you very much. On the motion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Appreciate it.
There, thank you very much. Senator Bonoff, we're going to take your bill next, Senate File 2758, and then we would like to also do Senator Latz's bill, 2347. And Senator Carlson, I have a feeling we're going to be coming back tonight for your bill.
Can't do it tonight. What time tonight?
We'll discuss that. We'll
the A2 amendment, and they've got it up there. And, okay. Madam Chair,
I have an author's amendment.
I do. I have an amendment that it puts the bill in the shape that I'd like it in. I'd offer the A2. And, Madam Chair, members, I will do my best to be as brief as possible.
The A2 amendment?
It's
So, Senator Bonner, I think this is on the same theme that we've been talking with.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, this is the Minnesota Entrepreneurial Resource Virtual Network for those legislators who went to the day at the Humphrey, and we talked about the importance as we position Minnesota for economic growth and in the competitive global marketplace, the need to streamline what we present ourselves as to the public. This moves us in that direction, creating a one-stop shop, a virtual portal for small business so that they can come to this and have everything they need. We know we do much in that way, but there's more to do. As we saw, what Michigan was doing was quite impressive, and so I do have Mike Myrie here
the
from
A2
D.
Amendment first.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
I think everyone has the A2 Amendment. It is an author's amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails. Senator Bonoff, you
Madam
have
Chair, the, what
testify.
The amendment does, in effect, is it takes the appropriation out of the bill. It came to our attention that the chamber felt as though that we could work in partnership between the chamber and DEED, which we already do, and they felt as though we could raise private funds to make this happen. And so, in fact, we did take the appropriation out, and then also Senate Council made some minor changes to have the bill in the best possible shape.
Excellent. And welcome to the committee. Please identify
Thank
yourself
you.
For
it's
the
a,
record.
It's a joy to testify after that last bill. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would encourage you, as I and I'll be as elegant as I possibly can, to just listen to a few facts about the environment of business or small business in the state of Minnesota. You know, the state of Minnesota has 511,000 small businesses, and 494,000 of those, or 96.7% of those, are what we define as micro enterprises, businesses with fewer than 20 employees. And it is those micro enterprises that employ over 807,000 of our private sector non-public employees, which make up about 28% of our employment. And small businesses create 78.4% of the new jobs, and those that have fewer than 20 employees actually account for 98% of those new employees. It's also small businesses who contribute over 50% of our gross domestic product, and it is those small businesses who also file patents at a rate of about 13 times more than our large businesses. And the U.S. Small Business Administration says that about 65 to 80% of our businesses fail within the first 5 years. And 40% of those due to a lack of knowledge, and 52% of those due to a lack of experience. Get to the bill.
I'm moving fast.
All right. What we recognized, certainly.
Yeah,
In this bill, it helps us continue the work and make accountable DEED for the further development of an entrepreneur development system, which makes available or categorizes resources that are available to entrepreneurs and to small businesses. It helps us continue to work with the Minnesota Chamber that we started with its Business Connection website, and we just ask that you support this bill.
Thank you, Rich. I do want to note, I know that this was part of what came out of some discussions with the Small Business Caucus.
Yes.
I think it goes back to some earlier points we heard about. This is a good idea coming from the business community to, you know, the legislature. So that's why we absolutely have to make sure that, you know, agency staff are listening carefully to the people who are on the front line of needing.
That's right.
And so I really appreciate that. Are there any questions, Senator?
Well, Madam Chair, it sounds like Senator Bonoff and these folks have done a lot of work on this, and I think we ought to get it on out of here.
I think that unless there's anyone else who would like to testify,
money.
Senator
Go right
Bonoff.
To the floor.
Great. Is it, Senator Thomas, do you want to see this in economic development? It was scheduled.
I didn't look real close.
No
fiscal note.
There's no fiscal note?
There's
no financial, no fees, nothing in this?
I
no.
don't
Did
believe
read
so.
It?
Read the bill.
All right. In that case, Senator Bonoff, your bill, if you'd like to, Senator Scheid.
I'm sure I just have a quick question on the, in looking at the summary of results, the very first paragraph threw me, and I'm not sure I understand it. The second sentence says, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, there were about 370,000 Minnesota owner-run and operated businesses with no employees in 2007. I don't.
Those are
self-employed.
Self-employed.
Okay.
Sole proprietorships.
I Sure.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Very good.
Thank you. So moved.
Very
Madam
good.
Chair.
And so with that, Senator Bonoff is moving her bill 2758 and going
Madam Chair, I'm told that they're seeking private sector funding. I don't know if that matters or not, but it's for the Office of Enterprise and Small Development Business. I think this does have to come through my committee.
No, I don't think it does.
This is public or private money.
It's private money.
Right. On the motion, all those in favor? Signify by saying aye.
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 You know, we could, Senator Latz, could, you know, I'd like to somehow try to get this Carlson thing, Senator Carlson's Latzy quickie. That's what the Latz is quick. Senator Latz.
What's this? What's this bill?
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill would bring Minnesota law to the same number of hours required before overtime is available, or it must be paid from 48 hours under current law to 40 hours, which is essentially the federal standard and the standard in at least 31 states in our country. So that's the proposal. I do have the A6 amendment that would put this bill in the shape in which I'd like it to be considered, and this is our first committee.
On that motion.
Okay. I will move the Latz A6 motion to get it in the shape. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Latz. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. You have in your packet a letter from the AFL-CIO in support of this bill. You also have documentation from the U.S. Department of Labor identifying the states that already have 40-hour work weeks. I think most people assume, sometimes incorrectly, that Minnesota is a 40-hour work week state. In fact, our statute provides for 48. Most businesses in Minnesota are covered by federal law, which has 40 hours before you have to be paid time and a half for overtime. So passage of this bill would frankly bring Minnesota law in alignment with what most workers in Minnesota, what people in Minnesota think is the law. I have with me Michelle Fisher, a partner at Nichols Castor, a law firm that is experienced in wage and hour law, to provide some commentary on this, and I'd ask for your support. Okay, ma'am, welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Thank you. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I work at a plaintiff's law firm. We do employment litigation, and my practice for the past 10 years has been wage and hour litigation. And what I'd like to give you are three reasons for this amendment to the bill. The first reason would be that Minnesota really needs to get in line with the rest of the country.
State your name for the record.
Michelle Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R. Sorry.
Okay, Fisher. Ms. Fisher.
The first reason, Minnesota really needs to get in line with the rest of the country. We litigate these wage and hour cases all over the country, and Minnesota's overtime law is very unusual in terms of how many hours are required before employees receive overtime pay. 31 states, including Minnesota, have overtime laws. 19 states do not have overtime laws. But if you look at the 31 states who have overtime laws, all of them pay overtime after an employee reaches 40 hours, which is consistent with the federal law. And all of these legislatures have determined that a 40-hour week is a reasonable work week, and anything beyond that should be paid at an overtime rate. So what we'd be asking is that Minnesota, we're already ahead of the states like Alabama and Mississippi
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fisher, I don't mean to cut in on your testimony, but I think that there's probably going to be a positive vote coming out of this committee here. I only have one question, and it's down here below the effective date. It talks about whose overtime compensation is set by a collective bargaining agreement existing as of June 1st, blah, blah, until the expiration of that agreement. Sometimes we don't have our contract signed, and we have people that work 48 hours one week and maybe 28 hours the next week, but they get paid as a standard 40-hour work week. And our contracts, if our contract expires, then that's done. We can't do the 12-hour under this. We won't be able to have 12-hour shifts any longer. You're going to have a hard time convincing the firefighters that that would be a good deal there, Senator Latz. So we're going to have to find different language for until the expiration of that agreement. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to work with Senator Murphy on that. Our point was not to interfere with existing collective bargaining agreements.
Right. But or future collective bargaining agreements that look like the ones that they currently have.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Latz, we've had conversations about this. Just so I'm clear, the federal ag exemption of 48 hours will still apply?
How come not tomorrow?
For overtime rate for ag farmhands?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, we did put a specific provision in the bill that would exempt ag implement dealers and mechanics and so on, and that was specifically the information, the feedback that I had received from the agriculture community where there was a concern. There are already some exemptions in Minnesota law relating to certain categories of ag farmhands, as I understand it. If there's something else I need to deal with, I'm happy to talk with individuals about that, if what we have in here didn't capture the exemption properly for that.
Mr. Chair, I'll be in touch and see where we're at, but then that leads me to the question on line 114 and 115, why are these sugar beet farmhands specifically spelled out separately?
Mr. Chairman, that's existing law. I can't explain it.
But existing law is 48 hours, and you're changing that to 40.
That's correct. I can speculate, if I might, that there are certain categories of employees where they have a very intense short period of time in order to get some of the work done, rather than being sort of the regular pattern throughout the year. And sugar beet workers are probably in that category. They got a real short period of time to get that harvest in, and then.
Senator Skoy, let me ask Mr. Fuller, excuse me, to maybe help out here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, it's still an absolute exemption. It's just a reference to what the standard is changed from 48 to 40. So they're still exempted with the same language. It doesn't change their obligation whatsoever, sugar beet growers.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator Fuller, Skoy. With regard to my question, current law for ag employees is 48 hours, and then after that you pay overtime. Is this changing that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, as Senator Latz said, this bill is effective in 2011. It does not pick up any federal exemption. Federal law allows us to set a higher standard. There are a number of exemptions in state law for agricultural worker, and I'm not sure if they parallel the federal ones. I doubt they exactly parallel them, but one would have to look at those. And under state law, they'd be exempt totally as well if they were not defined as an employee.
Press committee? Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Okay, I think here's what we're going to do.
I think I have Senator Latz's assurances he's going to work with me on this.
We also had a question on your bill. I think what we're going to do is Senator Rosen?
No, go ahead.
Go ahead, Michelle.
I was doing it for you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm too very confused about line 14. And when you take the broad flyover view of this, this is very incomplete, and it needs a lot of work here. I'm confused. And I do have some questions about the cost.
Why don't we do it Monday?
If there has been some cost analysis, that how much is going to cost employers on a whole, and what the cost have been in the other states. I know 30 other states have done that, but I'm not convinced yet that is the correct thing to do.
Mr. Chairman.
I'll talk out loud. I think we should try to get a room, if at all possible, tomorrow to work just a little bit on your language, Senator Latz, and then I think Senator Carlson might take some time. Would But you've got to get yours out to get to another committee. But I'm trying to avoid tonight if I can. I don't know, unless you guys all want to hang around or what. But
let's take a survey. Who wants to come back tonight?
Okay, you'll be alone. But you'll have a lot of power, though. You'll
Adam
be chairing the committee.
Can I have that mallet?
Adam Chair.
And it's recess, so it's still a quorum. Oh, no.
I'll be here, Mr. Chair, tonight for another bill. I'd be off to do this with Senator Rosen. So.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I realize I don't speak for everybody, but we have about 4 hours of commerce tomorrow and about 6 hours of judiciary. And some of that's concurrent. It's going to be tough.
What time do you meet at Commerce, 12:30?
Yes, till about 4:30.
11?
Well, Mr. Chair.
And then
on your committee. I'm on your
3.
Committee. Anybody?
I'll be next to you. Mr. Chair.
We could get this room for a half an hour at 12:30, but then I'd be gone and you'd be gone. But then it might run a little better.
And I'd be gone.
12:30.
And Senator Sparks.
Oh, I thought he was. Is he a senator?
He's a
senator. Oh. Okay, well, we're not going to get done here now. So, we can have this room at 12:30. I think we're going to do that, 12:30 tomorrow.
Okay.
And then we'll move back and forth, and because you're going to go all day. And we're just going to go about 45 minutes or an hour, I hope.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonham.
Would 12 o'clock work? Because then.
Yeah, then we could probably get a little closer, right?
I think so, Mr. Chair, and people could just. Maybe you'd make an exception, let people eat at their tables, Mr. Chair.
Let's do it at 12, but be here, okay?
And the chair is providing pizza, so all right.
All right.
Good.
What did you say? All right.
The chair
12
of this
o'clock
committee.
Tomorrow.
No, I don't know. You ask me.
Bonding on the floor, what time?
Yeah. Maybe at 11. But we wouldn't know.
We're going to leave it at 12 tomorrow, see what happens. Meeting's adjourned. And then, Senator Latz, if you've got some cleanup stuff, work with Senator Rosen and Scoy and whoever else was talking about your bill.
Okay.
Meeting's adjourned.